Space City. Flickering dirty neon over alleys mean and dirty streets, while my neighborhood is torn down around me. Too many people on the zombies.
Welcome to the nightclub at the end of the world. The divas of doom are coming at you tonight. I'm Carolyn Baker, sitting in for Mike Rupert, who is away attending ceremony and will be back next week. Tonight, it is my great pleasure to have on the show with me Gail Zawacki, whose blog Wits End many of you are familiar with, and who's also the author of the book Pillage, Plunder, and Pollute, which you can download for free at Wits End or buy in hard copy. Many of you also know Gail as a daily contributor to the Near Term Extinction Support Group on Facebook. The address for Gail's blog is WitsEndNJ, that's all one word, lowercase, WitsEndNJ.blogspot.com. And we're going to be taking callers tonight toward the end of the show, so please listen up and give us a call with comments or questions in the last segment of the show at 888-874-4888. Gail is a lifelong gardener living on a small farm in New Jersey with horses and poultry. She's done a number of fascinating jobs in her life, but right now she's a freelance writer and blogger, and she's been very active with Occupy Wall Street, having gotten arrested a couple of times, and she also protested mountaintop removal in West Virginia and was a writer for Dave Roberts at the Grist website in August 2012, following the shutdown of the largest mountaintop removal in the country. She was arrested twice for activism, one time at Occupy Wall Street and another time in Washington, D.C. for protesting with 350.org. Welcome to the show, Gail.
Thank you for having me, Carolyn.
You're welcome. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
You did. I'm impressed.
Okay. Zawacki, I just thought Milwaukee, you know, it's kind of rhymes.
Well, the Polish people say Zawacki, but...
Zawacki?
Yeah, Zawacki.
Okay. All right. So I'll try to remember that. You know, one of the things that I always like to ask other activists, and particularly people who are so aware of our planetary predicament, is... when exactly did you start waking up? Can you tell us a bit of your story?
Sure. I've always been an environmentalist, you know, sort of tree hugger type. And I've always been concerned about nuclear weapons and things. But and I was sort of politically active, but I never took it very seriously as a life-threatening danger that we're facing until 2008. And then it kind of fell on me like the sky opened up, and it was a revelation almost overnight. And since then I've come to meet a lot of people and who are sort of doomers, I guess you would call them, and a lot of them come to it from peak oil from years before I became aware, or they come to it from overpopulation. But I have a little bit of a different perspective, because I just one day realized that all the trees were dying. And as soon as I don't know really even why I realized that, I just saw them suddenly, and I saw that they were dying, and that took me on a journey that led straight to mass extinction.
Uh-huh. So that was going to be the next question that I was going to ask you is, when did you start waking up to the concept of near-term extinction?
Well, I think I came at it because of the trees, and I looked at it really from the very beginning as a question about evolution, because evolution, if you understand how long it takes for things to evolve and how complex all the relationships are, you can't just yank something out like the climate and have everybody adjust. It just doesn't work that way. And so I looked at it from the paleo... I initially thought it was climate change that was killing the trees. So I spent about a year reading about climate change. And one of the first books I read was With Speed and Violence by Fred Pierce. And he looks at it from the paleoclimate point of view, what has happened in the past. And in fact, climate change happens very rapidly in the past. It can happen in a... it can flip in a decade. Really amazing things can happen. And it's always followed by mass extinctions when you have a flip like that in the climate. And so that's I from the very, like almost from day one, I realized that that's where we were headed. And in terms of the near term part of it, I'm not sure how near term it's going to be. I don't think anybody really knows, but I figured it was going to be near term because as soon as you read the scientific papers, they're so full of holes, really, that the assumptions they make, they're missing the amplifying feedbacks. I realized that right away. And they're also missing the fact that the trees are dying. Almost, I don't think there's a single scientist, really, who's factoring that in. And of course, that's one of our, if not the major, CO2 sink. So without those trees soaking up CO2, everything's going to be on a much more rapid trajectory than any of the models are predicting. So
right.
That's where my near-term issues
okay.
come in.
And then you've been very influenced, I think, by Guy McPherson's work and
mm-hmm.
his research. Can you say a little bit more about how that has influenced you?
I really admire Guy, and I admire his courage. He's very courageous, and he's taken a lot of hate from people and does all the time. He's a lightning rod for this issue. So I really admire him tremendously. And I guess it was maybe like 6 months or maybe even a little more that I started reading his blog on a regular basis and interacting with the people and the comments on his blog. And it was a great learning experience. I got kind of frustrated with a lot of the he doesn't moderate it at all, which is fine, and that's the way he wants to run it, and that's great. But it just meant that there was a lot of stuff there that I didn't want to read.
You and me both. Every time he publishes one of my articles, I never look at the comments because. For the same reason you don't read it either.
Yeah, there's a lot of vitriol, and there's also a lot of, there were a lot of religious people coming on, and I just can't, I just feel like I have enough to deal with near-term experience.
Right.
I don't need to hear somebody's fantasy about their religion on top of it. So I recently kind of shifted focus, and I've been on Facebook a lot more, which is wonderful. I mean, I've really made some solid friends on Facebook, I feel. And I guess originally when I first started reading about climate, I was reading Joe Rome's blog and got involved with that community there that commented. Which is climateprogress.org.
Right.
He's a great writer, and it was really, really informative. And I've probably met at least five people that were in that comment community and gotten to be really good friends with them, friends in Seattle and California and New Hampshire. So that was a wonderful resource for me. But I also got sort of tired of that after a while because it's full of people with hopium, you know, people that
right.
think that technology is going to fix it or better messaging is going to make a difference. And I just got past that after a while.
Mm-hmm. Good. Okay, well, you've done a tremendous amount of research on trees and the effects of ozone on trees. Would you say a bit more about that?
Yeah, I could go on for a while.
Well, it's okay.
It's a very, in some ways it's a very simple concept, and in other ways it's very, very complicated because there's a lot of different branches of science that are involved in it, which is probably why very few people pay much attention to it because it involves so many different disciplines. It involves atmospheric physics and chemistry and biology, and the way that science is so specialized now, it's hard to find people that put it all together. There are some, but they're few and far between. So when I first realized that the trees were dying, like I said, I thought it was climate change. And I read about climate change. So that was the summer of 2008, and I really thought that until the summer of 2009. And then I started paying very, very close attention to everything that was going on around me. And I realized something very interesting, which is that ozone will visibly injure leaves. So it has certain types of symptoms on leaves that you can see pretty readily. And what I realized in the summer of 2009, which took me by surprise, is that plants that were being, I mean, the mechanism of climate change killing trees, it's really one of two things. It's either got to be temperature or it's got to be precipitation. So the temperature hasn't really changed all that much. It has gone up, but it hasn't gone up so that it would bother trees because trees, some of them are thousands of years old. They've been in and out of different temperature regimes. And So that brings me, it has to be drought. So I thought it was drought. But what I realized in the summer of 2009 is that plants that are in pots, like flowering plants, like tropical flowering plants that like heat, that are being watered, their leaves are having the same issues that the trees were. Or even plants that are growing in ponds, like water lilies and lotus, their leaves have the same problem. Or trees that are growing right next to a pond or a river, okay, so even if it's a little bit dry, they're there where there's plenty of water. They all look equally bad. So at that point, I was like, if it's not the precipitation that's creating this injury on the leaves, it has to be something in the air. And that is when I started reading about ozone, and I realized that it's a subject that been covered now for really going back to the 17th century. People understood that air pollution would injure trees. And certainly modern science picked up on it in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s when it was being reported as issues in Japan and Europe and Pakistan and India and, of course, in the U.S. and Canada. So when I had a lot of resistance when I first thought that it was air pollution. Because for one thing, I moved out to the country to raise my children in a healthy environment. So the idea that there was air pollution out where I live, which is very rural, I rejected it. I was like, that's ridiculous. But the thing about ozone is that you can't see it. So you can't see CO2 either or oxygen, and we all know that they're there. But the ozone is there as well. And what happened was when they started regulating pollution, from cars and from coal plants, they did a pretty good job, at least in this country, of taking out the sulfur dioxide. And that's the smoky part of smog, the part you can see, the brown haze.
Right.
But they didn't take out the nitrous oxides. And that's what turns into ozone. It's a precursor, in other words. Ozone isn't something that comes out of your car or comes out of a smokestack. The nitrous oxides come out. And they go, they drift, they can go a very long distance, they can go across the Pacific Ocean from China to California. And then at some point, depending on the weather and the UV radiation and the volatile organic compounds, they all start interacting and they go in and out of these very complicated chemical reactions. But that's where the ozone comes from, and you cannot see it. So I think that's one reason that so many people are completely unaware that it's a problem, because they don't see it. And you hear people say things like, we should plant trees because they clean the air. And they do clean the air. But what people don't ask is, well, what happens to the tree that's soaking up that pollution?
Right.
That would otherwise be making us sick.
Yeah.
And it's very bad for the trees. In fact, it's vegetation, because vegetation processes so much CO2, they use it for food as their building block. They soak in a lot of more pollution than we do in our lungs. Because we eat food too,
right.
You know, we don't get our food from breathing the air. So it's actually more damaging to vegetation than it is to people.
Well, you know, you have just done a tremendous amount of research on this. I'm very impressed, and you know, you write about this a great deal on your blog. And I wonder what actually motivated you to start your blog.
Well. I started out when I first realized the trees were dying. I got very, very upset. Because, as I said, I could see the implications right away. And I was very worried about my daughters and, you know, not having a habitable planet to live on and things like that. So I started writing to a lot of different scientists and foresters and environmental groups, anyone I could think of that that might have answers for me or that might become engaged in the issue. That was an education, too, because nobody was interested. It was very sad.
Yeah.
It's not a popular topic. I was emailing people, and I was taking pictures of the trees and emailing. This is like almost ancient history now with the internet. I was emailing people pictures of the trees, and it was very cumbersome because at that time it took a really long time to load pictures on an email, and it took a long time for people to download them when they received my email. So that's why I thought, well, if I do a blog, I can just send them a link to the blog. And it would be more efficient. So that's one reason I started it. And I started, and also, you know, on a personal level, just as kind of a bearing witness thing, so that my kids, if they ever decide they want to look at it, it will be there for them. They will see it. At least I tried. You know, I don't know what else to do, honestly.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, starting a blog or a website or a section, a particular section on Facebook is a really excellent way of bearing witness, and it's kind of therapeutic for everyone mm-hmm. who's involved in it. So I'm really glad you have this blog. And your most recent blog post has a title that I absolutely love. It's called A World of Wounds. Can you say more about that title and how you came up with it?
Oh, I stole it from a quote, and I better go look at it.
I like it. I like it.
What was the quote? It was at the top of the... Oh, I know. It was it Aldo Leopold about
yes,
ecology?
Yes, I think it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was his quote about ecology. Yeah, because he's talking about what it's like to really see the world as it is, as injured as it is, because I'm sure you're familiar with this concept of shifting baselines, mm-hmm. but people tend to judge what they see by what they saw yesterday or maybe
right.
last year, but certainly not when they were little or what their grandparents saw. And I think the notion first came up talking about the ocean and the fact that we've lost so much life in the ocean. I think it's like 90% of the big fish are gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so the shifting baseline concept came from that, but it applies equally well to trees. I mean, people look at trees now, and I don't think they're really seeing them as damaged as they are. You know, I see them, and I see injured leaves that are scorched and brown and falling off early and not turning fall colors, and I see bark falling off and branches breaking. Or here's another one. When I was a kid, I never heard of a tree falling on anyone or a car or a house.
Right.
And that's almost routine now.
Yeah.
That happens all the time.
Yep.
I mean, I kind of keep loose track of people being killed by trees falling on them.
Right.
And it's just every thunderstorm. You know, the tree falls on their trailer, or they're walking down the street, or there have been two or three people in Central Park in New York that have been hit by falling trees.
Mm-hmm.
That used to be unheard of.
I know. Yeah. You know, I think we all have different species that we feel protective of as we deal with our predicament on this planet. You know, mm-hmm. some of us, it's like, you know, oh, the animals and oh, the rhinos are going to be gone in 10 years or the elephants in 20 or whatever. And your thing is trees. And, you know, I don't know why that is for you, and maybe you don't know either, but, you know, it's somebody needs to be doing this and talking about trees, and I'm really glad you are.
But one of the reasons, I mean, I do love them, and actually one of these days I'm going to do a post about the history of almost every culture has some kind of tree worship and legends about trees,
yes.
and myths about trees. They're very important, and most people kind of know that in a way. But one of the reasons I thought the trees were important and the fact that they're dying from pollution, and I thought that environmentalists and climate scientists would care because they are so important to the climate. Not only do they soak up the CO2, but they also, through this process of evapotranspiration, they regulate rain. And as we're seeing in California, we really need rain.
Yes.
And without trees, it's another self-reinforcing cycle. You know, if the trees die, then you don't get the rain, and then there's drought, and then the trees die more.
Right.
So I really thought that environmentalists and climate change scientists and activists would get interested in this. And I found out to my despair that they're not.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons is my theory is it's so threatening. Like Jim Hansen, for instance, who's my hero, I really admire him for a lot of reasons. But if you read his papers about what needs to happen, he doesn't just say, well, we need to stop putting CO2 in the air. He says we have to start taking it out because we're already too high. We're already past the safe level. That's where 350 came from, and as everyone knows, we're pushing 400 now.
Right.
So and climate.
Well, the problem with Mr. Hansen is that he's starting to talk now about nuclear power as being a silver bullet to save us from all of this. And,
well, he always has, though. But
yeah.
I think he has a realistic notion that a lot of climate change activists reject. And what he realizes that they don't is that we're not going to power industrial society with clean energy.
Right.
It's not going to be enough. And he knows that. And that's why he's pro-nuclear. I think the same thing's probably true for Monvia and some other mm-hmm. really prominent climate people that endorse nuclear. But anyway, what I was going to say about Jim, about the trees, is that he his plan to draw down CO2 is to plant trees.
Mm-hmm.
That's his plan, because we have no technological way to do it at scale. So his plan is to plant trees all over the world. So he's one of the first people I contacted. I think it was in 2008 or early 2009, and I wrote to him. He's very nice, and he wrote back. He goes, yeah, he said, that's really interesting. Actually, I just had to cut down a whole bunch of dead trees, because he's got a farm out in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And then he dropped it. He would never talk about it again. And after I read his paper, and I realized that this is his prescription to save the world for his grandchildren, as to plant trees. Well, of course he doesn't want to hear that they're all dying.
Right, right.
You know,
so, you wrote this wonderful book, Pillage, Plunder, and Pollute, and I haven't read it, I must confess, but tell us a little bit about it. I noticed it's also available in hard copy, and people can download it at your website.
Yeah, I put it on Amazon. It's like $20 or something, just so if people are the type of people that want a hard copy,
right.
It will be there. But they can certainly download it for free. And it's long and convoluted, because what I did was what I run into so much with this issue about the extent of damage that ozone's doing is a lot of people don't believe me. And, of course, I'm not the only person that's saying this, but I'm one of the few. And so what I did with the book was I said in the beginning, I threw everything, including the kitchen sink, into that book, like every piece of evidence I could think of, just to have it there as sort of a repository.
Mm-hmm.
But a shorter and updated version of it, if people can't wade through it, is a guest post I did for Greg Layden, who has a science blog.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a link for that at the top of my blog also. And it's called Whispers of the Ghosting Trees. So it's long, too, but it's not quite as long as the book. And it's a little bit more current.
Mm-hmm. And when did you actually publish the book?
I hope I have it right. I think it was in 2012.
Okay.
It wasn't last spring. I think it was the spring before. And I think it was last January, just about a year ago, that I did the Whispers of the Ghosting Trees for Greg Layden.
Okay. What? Tell me a little bit about your work on mountaintop removal and the title of your guest post at the GRIST website.
Well, I didn't make up the title. Dave Roberts made that up, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, I think.
Now, some people may not know who he is.
He's a blogger. He's a very great writer, and he wrote for Grist for quite a while. He's now sort of on sabbatical. I think he got really burned out, is what I think happened. But you can read his past columns, and he also has an excellent, excellent TED Talk called Climate Change is Simple,
mm-hmm.
which you can just go to YouTube and Google it. And it's a very short talk, and it's, if you have any friends that are climate change deniers that need persuading, that will go a long way probably towards persuading them.
Yeah, it's a good talk. It's a great talk.
Yeah, it's a good talk. And he asked me to do that sort of story after I went to the mountaintop removal protest, because we'd been talking about it online anyway, and he said he was going to take a vacation or something, and he said, would you do a guest post for me for while I'm away? And I said, sure. So I sat down for like 72 hours and knocked it out, and managed to infuriate everybody on every side of the question.
Yeah.
Which I didn't expect, that after four quarters, you know, I have a talent for that. Yeah, but it was a really interesting experience. I was very hesitant to go to West Virginia, but my middle daughter at that time actually was at a one-year clinic externship. She's a horse vet in Lexington, Kentucky. So I thought, well, if I go to the protest in West Virginia, I'll be close. I can go see my daughter, which would be really nice. So that added to the motivation. And then a young girl from New York went on the rideshare board, and she wanted a ride to West Virginia. So that kind of clinched it. I thought, well, at least, you know, I'm bringing another person down there. And the Rams people in West Virginia had put out this plea, please, please, you know, come and help us shut down this this coal site. Of course, none of us, except the organizers, none of us knew where we were going to go exactly. And they had us come down for almost a week before the actual protest, which before I went, I thought was kind of ridiculous. I was like, do I really have to camp out on this farm in the middle of nowhere for a week? You know. But once I got there, I realized that it's really important. They do all these it's very intensive training. Like from the minute you get up in the morning until you go to bed at night, all kinds of different meetings and instructions and practices and things. And it was a good thing, really, that they did that. I could see in hindsight. But it was a very fascinating experience, and it was great to meet the people. But I guess my perspective on it wasn't as PC as it should have been, so I got in some trouble.
Well, you know, Gail, you've mentioned a couple of times that you have children, and I'm wondering how you feel about their future. Can you talk with them about the issues that you write about in your blog?
Well, they're each different.
Right.
So there's three of them. The oldest is 31, and then I have a 25-year-old and a 28-year-old. I think I have that wrong, but anyway, something like that. And they're each individually somewhat different. They all know what I think. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, as I told you earlier, and as I realized that trees are dying, and I was learning about climate change, and then I was learning about pollution, I was talking to them about it as I was going through this process myself, and that was probably not a good idea.
Right.
Because they almost saw how bad it is before I did. Mm-hmm. And my oldest daughter made a crack at one point. She got kind of annoyed with me. She goes, okay, Ma, I get it. Someday I'm going to be eating the horses. Which for her to say that is horrible because she lives for her horses.
Right.
She's a really good, really skilled, competitive rider in dressage. And she lives horses, you know, 24/7. And for her to make a crack like that, you could see that she really understands how serious the issue is, but none of them want to live that way. My middle daughter said to me once, she's been to every continent on earth. She loves to travel, and she's a horse vet, and she was going to now climb Mount Kilimanjaro one time. And I said something sort of rather mild to her, and I said, you know, it's really not very good for your carbon footprint to fly to Africa. And she said, I want to see the snows before they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
I thought, you know what, actually, I can respect that. I mean, from the point of view from the kids or the people, the young people that inherited this mess that we should have figured out in 1972 when the Limits to Growth came out.
Exactly. Yep.
Why should they, you know, basically we're saying to them, you don't have much of a future. I mean, you know, you might have another 5 years or 10 years or 15 or even 20, but ultimately you're not going to retire the way your grandparents did.
Right.
So why should they take kindly to that? In fact, I keep thinking that when the young people really understand how gypped they've been, they're going to get pretty ticked off.
I think you're right. I think you're right.
And justifiably so.
You know, I wanted to ask you, what are your major concerns, frustrations, fears, sorrows regarding our planetary predicament? If you can summarize that. That's a lot. You know, do you?
Yeah, yeah. I can start crying.
Your top three, maybe.
Yeah. Well, I guess the way I see things coming down is that there's going to be. First and foremost, there's going to be food shortages.
Mm-hmm.
You can see it in California. It's right on the horizon there. And they provide so much of the fruits and vegetables in this country. So you're going to see food getting really, really expensive, and then shortly after that, it's going to be in short supply, and then people are going to go berserk. That's what I think is going to happen, and it's going to be really horrible because when people go berserk over food, things get really ugly.
Yes.
And so my own personal fears, you know, to get back to my children is for their safety, you know.
Right.
I mean, it's one thing to say, oh, well, if this is all a very slow thing and we can all, you know, just kind of like get the whatever, the nitrous oxide out and put the bag over our head and go out peacefully. But I don't think that's going to be an option for a lot of people. I think it's going to get, you know, when you're going to have the climate is going to, is already, we're already seeing absolutely insane weather.
Right.
And that's going to drive the grid down. And when the grid goes down and you've got people in cities that are in high rises and the toilets aren't flushing and the garbage isn't being picked up and it's dark.
Well, we saw that with Sandy. And, you know, right now, you know, Robin Westerna put on a wonderful picture from AccuWeather.com on Facebook a few hours ago. And when you see where the jet stream is going, I mean, it's going down below Florida. I mean, this is insane. You know, there's going to be another polar vortex, and right now it's -43 in Chicago in terms of wind chill. So, yeah, I mean, that's going to take the grid down pretty quickly.
It is, yeah. That and just people going crazy. I mean, you're not going to get people going to work when they are looking for food for their kids.
Right.
So, you know, maintaining the grid means people have to do the work, you know.
Yes.
And so I just see collapse happening. I'm a fast collapser. I see it happening. Oh. I see it, whatever the trigger is exactly, it's hard to say that.
Right.
But I think there will be a trigger. And then because we're in such a complex system, it's going to sort of ricochet around really fast. And that's my own personal, that's what keeps me up at night that I worry about is how that's going to play out. And I don't think it's going to be nice.
Well, that kind of leads me into the next question. You're facing our predicament about as directly as anyone I know. So I'm also wondering what gets you up each day. What keeps you going?
It's probably my kids. I mean, honestly, if it was just me all alone and I didn't feel like I brought them into the world and had some responsibility, I'd probably just kill myself. I really would. I mean, I don't want to see the mess come down, but I think to put that burden on them that I did that would be horrible. It would be, you know, just be inexcusable, so I would never do that. But if I was, well, one thing I've discovered is that I'm much happier when I'm not at home. Mm-hmm. And I wrote to a friend of mine about it just this week because people were saying, why aren't you home? Because I'm not home right now. I'm not in New Jersey. I'm staying with my daughter and her husband. They have a winter house in Palm Beach. And people were like, why don't you go home? And I said, because I'm miserable there. And the way I described it, I said, it's to me, everywhere I go makes me sad now because I can see the ecosystem collapsing wherever I go. I've been to Costa Rica. I've been to California. I've been to Seattle. It's happening some places faster than others, but for sure the trees are dying all over the world. But it's like watching a person die. It's really sad. But when I go home, it's like watching my child die. It's just so much worse. So I find that if I go different places and kind of sort of observe what's happening with a little bit of dispassion, it keeps me interested and it keeps me from just giving up completely.
Well,
and,
you know, I'm going to have to stop you right there, Gail, just momentarily. We're going to need to take a break for a couple of minutes. So we'll be back. We're talking with Gail Zawadzki, and this is a fascinating woman who's been doing a lot of research. We're going to come back and talk with you in a moment, Gail, but we need to take a little break right now.
Let's see.
Once again, from New White Trash, It Would Be Strange, and thank you so much. Before I get back to Gail, Gail, who's just an amazing researcher and who manages Wits End blog, author of Pillage, Plunder, and Pollute, there's one thing that I want to mention before we resume the conversation and start taking calls. If you've been with us since the beginning of the show, you've heard the urgency in her voice and mine regarding the predicament of our planet. And one of the things that I'm going to stop and talk about here is something that we all need, and that is specific skills in dealing with the emotions that are coming up and will come up as the situation worsens. Now, I know that we can all stay stoned 24/7 if we want to, and everyone has a right to do that, or we can take our lives, which, although I'm not advocating in any way, I know also that everyone has a right to do that, but there's another way that I've found that can bring us more joy, inspiration, creativity, and vitality in our lives than we've ever experienced, and that is to work specifically and intentionally with these emotions. I'm talking about fear, anger, grief, despair, and yes, joy. And on Thursday night, February 6th, I'm beginning a 5-part webinar on befriending the dark emotions in turbulent times. The first session is free and will feature my dear friend and colleague Andrew Harvey, who many of you know. He's the author of The Guide to Sacred Activism and is the founder of the Institute for Sacred Activism. And in that session, we're going to deal with the first emotion, fear. But we're only going to scratch the surface of befriending the dark emotions in that session. There's a mother load of information and inspiration that I'm going to share in the following 4 sessions. The full price for the course is $79 with a discount for registration before February 9th. This is an opportunity to ask questions, to meet other people online who are dealing with collapse and near-term extinction and the dark emotions, and get a ton of tools for yourself. So I'm asking you to register now by going to my website at carolynbaker.net, and in the middle of the homepage, you have a link to the registration page for the course. So please, please, please do not miss this opportunity. So Gail Zawadzki, I'm curious what you do for fun, distraction, or diversion.
Well, like I said, I like to travel. And I should also say that getting back to the question that you asked me earlier, it really does help to talk to other people that are collapse aware. And the Facebook group has been really good because it's such a soul-crushing process to sort of understand something that's really quite obvious but most people are oblivious to, and when it does come to you, it's very painful and terrifying, and it's so part of the reason I kind of hang around is that I think it really helps people that are just learning about it to be able to find other people that are kind of not used to it, but at least have been thinking about it for a while and have been through what they're going through.
Yes, yes.
So that's part of what keeps me going. I also have a kind of sick sense of humor, so that helps. And I like to do things like I started doing macro photography because the big picture's so ugly, but you can still find really beautiful close-up things.
Yeah, absolutely.
In nature.
And I was going to ask you about your photography because it's really awesome, and it obviously plays a big role in your life.
Yeah, kind of. I've had a few people complain about it on my blog, like, why is that there? But for the most part, I think it's what I write about is often so boring because it's just straight science, and it's also so depressing. So I try to break it up with the pictures, and not just my pictures too, but I steal them from other people regularly. And I just feel like it kind of brings you through the text a little bit to be able to have some kind of visual context there.
Absolutely. Yeah, it really does. It's such a wonderful compliment to the research and the work that you're doing. And so one of the things, Gail, that often doesn't get talked about in the larger conversation about collapse or near-term extinction, which is one reason I wanted to have you on the show tonight, is the issue of gender and the kinds of conflicts that may arise between men and women in a world in chaos. And I know that you have some thoughts about that, and I'm wondering if you could elaborate a bit. Personally, I think it's the elephant in the room in every conversation between women and men as they talk about collapse or near-term extinction. So can you elaborate for just a bit, and then we're going to start taking some calls.
Sure. Well, I guess from my point of view, I guess you'd call me a determinist or something. I mean, I really think that people are ruled by their basest instincts and their hormones and things like that. And so whenever the issue of male-female relations come up, people get very agitated about it and that the lines get drawn very quickly. And it seems to be sort of PC to think that men and women are equal. I'm not trying to say that they're not, but I think that women have achieved equality, or at least legally they've achieved equality, because we do have a very wealthy society. And I think that with collapse, that's going to go away pretty quickly. And also, as a chicken farmer, I just don't think people are all that different from animals, or at all different from animals. And you can see the way that males and females behave if you look at the animal kingdom. And it's not very polite a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that as the veneer of civilization gets eroded, I think we're going to see a reverting to things that feminists like myself would rather not see. I think it's going to be really hard to not have that happen. And if you look at countries that are going through collapse already right now, or have gone through collapse, it doesn't go very well for the women.
Right.
So that's having three daughters, of course, again, that's something that really, really worries me quite
Absolutely.
A bit.
Absolutely. I just want to say to everyone, the number to call if you'd like to make a comment or ask a question is 888-874-4888. I'm talking with Gail Zawadzki, and as we're waiting for callers and just kind of continuing our discussion, I just want to say that Mike Rupert is doing very well and will be back with all of you next week. And I'd like to remind everyone that he does what he does for love. So if you want to send him a monetary gift for his efforts, you can do that by sending it to 27378 Red Cloud Avenue, Moffitt, M-O-F-F-A-T, Colorado, 81143. Continue with that train of thought, Gail, because I'm fairly certain you have more to say about that.
Well, I don't know if all the listeners realize that Carolyn and I met at the Four Corners conference last
The Age of Limits
May.
Conference?
The Age of Limits at Four Corners Farm in Pennsylvania. Carolyn was one of the presenters, as was Guy McPherson and Dmitry Orlov. And it was just fascinating to see how riled up people got over issues about sexism and patriarchy. It really came to dominate a lot of the conversations there, which completely shocked me. I didn't expect that at all. I really thought that people that were all sort of on the same page about collapse, even though there's most of the people there, I think, are sort of peak oil, slow catabolic collapse types, not near-term extinction, Guy McPherson collapse types. But still, I thought there would be a lot more harmony there, and it was pretty amazing to see how things fell apart as soon as the subject of patriarchy came up. So I did do a post about it. I'm not sure if I remember the name. I think it's if you Google Wits End and Jay, their revels are ended. I think that's the title of that post. But that reminds me, I was just going to say, if anybody, because ozone is a really complicated issue, and probably a lot of people think that I'm completely wrong about it, if anyone has questions, they're perfectly welcome to email me. Is that okay to say?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I'd be happy to.
And what is your
clarify.
Email address, Gail?
Sure.
And then we have one caller. Go ahead.
Okay. It's witsendnj, just like my blog, at yahoo.com.
Okay, thank you. We have Richard in Seattle who's calling in. Richard?
Yes, hello there. Thank you very much for this presentation. I met Gail when she came out to Seattle and got a personal tour of what to look for in the trees. And I think she really opened my eyes in a lot of ways that the trees really demonstrate a lot. Each species will demonstrate different injuries from ozone. And ozone sort of acts like a, it's kind of like an acid or it's a very caustic thing that can affect trees. And you can see it's most easily seen, as Gail pointed out to me, in older leaves as they decay. Younger leaves would not have that. Can you, I'm not explaining it well enough, but it was really fascinating to see.
Do you have anything to add, Gail?
Yeah, I should have said, I almost said when you asked me why I started my blog, I almost said, well, there's this guy Richard in Seattle.
That's very cool.
Who bugged me. So, in fact, I think I blamed him in my book, if I recall.
Yes.
But, yeah, the one thing that's interesting about the damage to the leaves of trees that's important to understand, a couple things. First of all, the tree is damaged before you can see injury on a leaf. So the first thing that happens, it's not just trees, actually, it's any kind of plant, including our annual crops like, rice and wheat and soybean. The first thing that happens is the roots shrink because the ozone, like Richard said, it is caustic. It even eats away at stone. So it's a pretty nasty stuff, highly reactive gas. So when it goes into the leaves, they become injured, and even before you can see that, the plant has to take energy and repair that damage, just like if you got a cut on your skin, you would have to grow a scab on it. So when the plant does that, it takes away energy from its roots, from growing its roots. So it happens over time. As cumulative damage occurs, the roots get smaller and smaller. So that means you've got a plant that is much less tolerant to drought and much more likely to blow over when it's windy. In fact, if you look at, I kind of make it a hobby of looking at pictures that are put in newspapers or on websites after storms of trees that have fallen over, and you can just see in so many of them, they have hardly any roots. I mean, they just come right off at the base.
Right. You know what, Gail, we've got another caller, Tom from Santa Rosa. Is there anything else you'd like to add to Richard's, to your comments or Richard?
No, let's go to Tom.
Okay.
Thanks, Richard.
Thank you, Richard.
Yeah, I didn't know if you were aware that the ozone hole shrunk by like 40% from September of 2001 to September of 2002. And part of my theory was that it might have something to do with all of the exhaust from jets because no one was flying after 9/11. The way the chemical reaction, I was thinking that might be with the exhaust from jets with the lightning might have created a chemical there's a rather large name for it, but it's a simple acronym. It was SF. It was four different letters. Anyways, it was supposed to be one of the most potent ozone-destroying chemicals around, and my thought was, well, geez, if that's what's making it, a lot of ozone would be depleted destroying that chemical, and it would only leave trace amounts, which is all they found in the ice core samples. I didn't know if you were aware of any of these aspects of the ozone hole with that.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because it's actually a completely separate issue, and I tend to forget that the ozone in the stratosphere is what you're talking about, and
the exact chemical is SF5CF3.
Uh-huh.
Okay, the chemical that I suspect, but it did close by 40% that year.
Well, yeah, and when 9/11 happened and the planes weren't flying, then we got a whole lot more UV radiation because the sulfates weren't being put up in the sky. So that was another interesting, unexpected effect. But just to clarify that the ozone that's in the stratosphere is normally there, and it's good that it's there because it does block UV radiation. That's why they banned the fluorocarbons that we're depleting it, because we need it. Otherwise, we would get too much UV radiation, and people get skin cancer, and all the plants would die. So that's good up there. What I'm talking about, and I should have been more clear about it, is tropospheric ozone, which is not natural for the most part. Only tiny bits of it would be natural.
Okay, so I understand. The major difference between the two.
It's actually the same substance, but it does very different things.
Ooh.
And it's in very different places. So what you were talking about, the ozone hole that we don't want,
okay,
is in the stratosphere, which is really high.
I did have one other thing I wasn't aware of. I didn't know if you were aware of. It was called the Marshall Hydrothermal System. And what this gentleman did was, his design is to take like a big cap like they dropped over the HP Horizon oil spill, and they vent up the steam from an ocean thermal vent from a volcano up to an oil platform, and it says it could produce about as much energy as 5 nuclear power plants from the steam. And he has a whole website up on that. I was hoping to be able to forward it to you. I'm glad you gave your email address. Was that Witch Hazel with two H's, so it's W-I-T-C-H? Hazel?
No, it's Wits End, like Shakespeare on that. My Wits End.
Oh, Wits End.
Yeah.
Okay.
W-I-T-S-E-N-D, and then N-J, like New Jersey.
Okay, Tom, we need to move on.
Thank you.
We have another caller, Phil from Los Angeles.
Good evening. Now, my question is, in terms of my personal set of skills, my fear is that, well, I have the combat skills and the firearm skills that could be required in some sort of grid down situation, and that my significant other, she probably won't appreciate that anxiety, or if I were to have to use them to defend her, I'm not sure that she would appreciate me or judge me for that kind of thing.
And what's your question?
Was that talked about during your discussion of patriarchy and all of that discussion?
Have you talked to her about it?
Oh, I've talked to her about it, but it's...
And?
Yes. She just doesn't think it will get that bad.
Well, you know, you have the option to go take, you know, concealed carry training or firearm safety training on your own. And, you know, you don't have to get her permission for that. And you can go do that on your own if you like. And, you know, not necessarily brandish your training in front of her, but that's something that you can do for yourself if you want to. You know, I think it's important for us to understand if we're in relationships, whether it's with significant others or children or whatever, you know, we don't all have to be on the same page about how to prepare. I mean, sometimes some issues are more problematic than others, but, you know, it's important for us each to prepare in our own way that we feel is helpful, and if that feels like something you need to do for yourself, then by all means do it. I don't think, however, that firearms training is going to solve the patriarchy problem or any other problem. You know, collapse and near-term extinction is not going to play out the way that we often think it will. We're going to be surprised by a lot of things, and so we prepare as best we can and then realize that we may have to change our plans at the last minute. Thanks for calling in, Phil. We've got Wendy in Ithaca, New York. Wendy?
Hello. My question is back to the discussion regarding personal relations between someone near-term extinction aware and, for example, a partner or a loved one that is unaware, and the negotiating that tends to go through the relationship when your priorities are different. It's a negotiation or I don't know what you would call it. It's definitely a learning new communication skill excuse anyway. Has anyone discovered a magic formula or a better way to discuss or communicate?
No one has discovered a magic formula, but I do.
You know what I mean.
I do, yeah. I do life coaching with people every single day about this particular issue. So if you would like to find out more about that, you can email me at carolyn@carolynbaker.net. That's Carolyn with a Y. And we can talk about that. I've done a lot of writing about it. I do a lot of coaching about it, and it is a huge issue. So perhaps we can talk about it in the future.
Yes, I just think that people aren't aware that that option is available to them. So
It's a huge, huge issue, and thank you for bringing it up.
Okay, no worries. Have a good night.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Any comments on any of that, Gail?
Well, I don't have a significant other at the moment, and I did for about 15 years, and he's a great guy, and he started out as a conservative Republican. I fixed that pretty quick.
You fixed that, yeah.
Well, no, honestly, it was just like Richard said that, you know, with me there pointing out things to him, he would start calling me saying, you should see these trees down here. They look terrible. So he kind of, you know, came right along with it. And that was really great. And I, ever since I went to that conference that we were talking about in Pennsylvania, I had no idea how many people are in a situation where they do have a partner, where the partner is either unaware or quite resistant to the idea of collapse. And we get a lot of people on the near-term extinction Facebook page that you brought up that really, I would say almost most of them are in that situation. Mm-hmm. And I just can't imagine anything being more difficult than having the person you're most intimate with in the world not being able to share something so important with. I have a lot of sympathy for people in that situation.
Yes, it is a very painful situation, and not only a situation where your significant other is on a different page, but you know, perhaps a child or a parent, if you're a younger person and your parent is often at different, you know, on a different page, or friends or people who, you know, I encounter so many people who are just, you know, they have no one to talk with. They might be in a huge city and it's very populated, but they have no one to talk with. So, I really appreciate the work that you're doing, Gail, with, providing so much on your blog and in the Near Term Extinction group. And, you know, I just think that it's so important that we have those places to be able to talk.
Yeah, it's really, I think it's, for some people, it's the only place they can go. I mean, people have said that. It's the only, I do actually have one really good friend that I've known for 30 years who understands collapse completely, but a lot of people don't even have that one person.
Okay, we've got about a minute to wrap up, and I just want to mention, once again, Gail Zavatsky's blog is Wits End, that's all one word, witsendnj.blogspot.com. Her book is Pillage, Plunder, and Pollute. She's a major contributor to the Near Term Extinction Support Group on Facebook. And I want to thank you so much, Gail, for being with us. Mike Rupert will be back next week on this program, sitting in again and steering the ship. And it's been a real honor for me to be able to sit in for him tonight. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, callers, for calling in. And Mike, we'll see you next week.
Thanks, Carolyn.